I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Sarah Song, professor of law and associate professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. We're discussing her 2019 book, Immigration and Democracy, from Oxford University Press. Song works on contemporary political and legal theory, feminist theory, and American political thought. She is the author of Justice, Gender, and the Politics of Multiculturalism from Cambridge University Press, as well as many articles on immigration, multiculturalism, and democratic theory. So first of all, Sarah Song, let me say thank you so much for being on the Political Theory Review with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sarah, the book was great. I loved reading it. It's extremely timely on a topic that we've all been thinking about immigration. It's a rigorous theoretical engagement with the topic, but it also you have a great facility with empirical work and the empirical literature. So it's unusual and very welcome. So thanks for writing the book. And I always ask to start off the conversation, what was the motivation for writing the book?
Yes. Well, first, thank you so much for having me on the podcast and for engaging with my book. So I think part of my motivation is personal. Perhaps all of our projects are in some sense, even a small part, personal. So my interest in immigration stems from my experience of being an immigrant. My family immigrated to the U.S. in 1980 when I was 6 years old from South Korea. My father had come the year before to study theology, and he was offered a job a year later, which allowed him to obtain a religious worker visa, and he was able to sponsor me, my brother, and my mom. And so we immigrated to a suburb of Kansas City, Missouri, and that's where I spent kind of formative years of my childhood, and I grew up around immigrants in the Korean church community and also around American friends in school and in the neighborhood. And I saw up close the challenges and opportunities that come with immigration. My motivation's also scholarly. So my first book, Justice, Gender, and the Politics of Multiculturalism, really focused on group differentiated rights. So thinking about how and when equality requires differential treatment for members of different groups. And in particular, I was interested in group rights for religious and cultural minorities, and exploring the tensions between group differentiated rights for such groups and the pursuit of equality for women. And many of the cases of cultural conflicts I was looking at involved immigrant communities. So I knew when I was finishing that book that I wanted to explore more directly immigration itself. And Joseph Kerens's work obviously is really seminal in on this topic. And, you know, from reading his theory of open borders, I felt that he didn't fully appreciate the importance of political community. And so I felt like there was more to be said in the debate, and there have been lots of contributors to this debate since Joe's early work on the subject. But yeah, those are some of my motivations.
Great. Well, so let's get into the topic. First of all, I mean, maybe you could say a little bit about the contemporary phenomenon of immigration, just to give us a sense. You say a little bit about it in the introduction, and I was hoping that you'd expand a little bit about it, just about on the sheer size, the sheer numbers of refugees and immigrants that we're talking about in the contemporary world. It's immense. It's an enormous and important political issue and problem. So maybe just give us a sense of the scope of it here.
Sure. Yeah, I think I'm glad you're starting with this, because it is important to have a sense of the empirical context within which we're theorizing. So according to the most recent World Migration Report that's put out by the UN International Organization for Migration, as of 2018, so last year, there are 244 million international migrants in the world. So that's about a little over 3% of the world's population. So the vast majority of people in the world continue to live in the countries in which they were born, you know, 97% of the world's population. But about 3% are currently residing in countries. They've migrated to other countries, especially countries within the general region of their countries of origin. And many are migrating to higher income countries than the countries that they come from. And work is the primary reason that people migrate internationally. And migrant workers currently make up a large majority of the world's international migrants. I should also say, included in that number of 244 million, it includes people who are forcibly displaced, both within their countries of origin, and they're called internally displaced persons, about 40 million currently internally displaced people, and also refugees, those who are forcibly displaced and leave their countries of origin, and most often are in neighboring countries, currently over 22 million international refugees. Maybe I could just say something about the U.S., which is the country that I know the most about, and kind of the trends in immigration in this country. So in 2016, around 1.5 million foreign-born people had moved to the U.S. And India was the largest sending country, followed by China, then Mexico, Cuba, and the Philippines. And I think it's just important to know that the percentage of immigrants that make up a share of the U.S. population has fluctuated over time. So in the late 19th to the early 20th century, the share of immigrants in the overall population was between 13 and 15%. There was that percentage went down as the country enacted restrictive immigration laws, enacted what are called national origins quotas to try to restrict the flow of immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe and prioritize immigration from Northern and Western Europe. The record low, actually, the percentage of foreign-born people in the U.S., 1970, it was just about 5% of the population were made up of people who had been born in other countries. I should say in recent years, in 2016, about 13% of the total population made up of immigrants, those who were born elsewhere. But it's important to note that that percentage is about the same as what it was between kind of 1860 and 1920. So fluctuations, but obviously the total number of immigrants, just as our population has increased, is greater now than it was in the past. But in terms of the percentage of the population that immigrants make up, it's not that much greater today than it has been in the past.
Right. So is it fair to summarize this as sort of, these things seem to go in waves. That is, there's a large influx of immigration, and then conservative backlash, which reduces the inflow of immigrants, reduces the share of immigrant population, and then there's an opening up once again, and now immigration population has gotten large again, and so then there's a kind of a new backlash. I mean you see this, I guess, in the U.S. but also in Europe. Is that fair to summarize?
Yeah, I think maybe it would be more accurate to say there have been periods of restriction and periods of openness. It hasn't always been a kind of steady oscillation between the two, but yes, and also you have to remember that economic conditions have also played a role. So during the Great Depression, right, when so many people were out of work, and government officials realizing that the need so it's been complicated with economic conditions, but also right political forces, and there have been periods of backlash. I would say 1965 was a really important turning point in U.S. immigration law, where we, the country with the Immigration and Nationality Act, opened up immigration beyond Europe to include Latin American countries, Africa, Asia. And so the racial composition of migrants coming after 1965 has been much more diverse than prior to that point. And some people might look back, right, on immigration since 1965 and say maybe part of what has fueled backlash in different periods has something to do with the racial and ethnic makeup of the people who are coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the reasons that I ask is because I'm a bit curious, and we can get to this later if you'd like, but how relevant this particular empirical side to the immigration debate is on your view, you know. So I mean, if the share of immigration and immigrants in any one country is higher versus lower, does that have any relevance on the kind of normative expectations or demands on the part of a country? You know what I'm getting at here?
Yes, and I think it'll come up when we talk more deeply about, for example, the responsibility to take in refugees, and thinking about whether a country has already taken in large numbers of refugees. You might think immediately of Germany. But also, right, are there other immigrants that they've taken in who are not refugees, and how that might factor into the obligations, or how they meet the obligations that I argue that they have to take in a fair share of refugees. But I think it will also come into play if we think about the concerns about backlash and whether to try to minimize forces of backlash, whether it's okay or permissible for a government to engage in ethnic selection or prioritize members of certain groups or not. And I'm very critical of that view as on the grounds that they violate democratic norms of equality. But I mean, we can talk more about it with respect to specific issues.
Yeah, good. And so to get into it, I think you do a nice job, I think, in framing the debate in terms of two kind of stark alternative views about immigration, two sort of normative takes one can take on immigration. On the one hand, there's the open borders view, that is, that any kind of restriction on immigration is wrong, and versus an immigration restrictionist view that it's permissible for the state to enact any and all forms of restriction. So maybe you could situate your view vis-a-vis these two stark alternatives somewhere in the middle, right?
Yeah, or I might say that there are important values that I share with each side. And I mean, if we need a visual way of thinking about it, maybe somewhere in the middle is okay. But yeah, let me clarify. So as you already said, you know, on one side are the open borders proponents. And it's not quite accurate to say the other side is closed borders entirely immigration restrictionist. I think the other side is really a group of scholars who argue that the state has the right to control immigration. And it's a separate but related question how it should exercise that right to admit or exclude different categories of migrants. And so you could have a position, and I think I would put my position in this category of, I believe there is a good argument in favor of the modern state's right to control immigration, but I argue that it should be exercised in such a way to to have what I call a policy of open doors. So maybe I could say a bit more about the side of those who believe the state has the right to control immigration. And so one prominent view has been articulated by Kit Wellman, and he appeals to the value of freedom of association. And so he uses these analogies that a country can control the admission of new members like a golf club can control the admission of new members. He also used the striking analogy with marriage. You can refuse a marital associate. You have the right to choose. No one can force one upon you. In the same way, members of a country can choose the new associates that they want to bring into the community. And I would say his is probably the closest to or the strongest restrictionist view, in the sense that an association can restrict even on the basis of race and ethnicity. And that is something that flows from freedom of association. Another view is David Miller, his recent book, Strangers in Our Midst. He really values, I mean, ever since his book on nationality, the value of national identity and a common national culture. And so he really conceives of the state and political community as defined or based on a shared national identity. And a really important goal of political communities is to preserve a distinctive national identity. And so you can restrict for the purpose of preserving a distinctive national culture, for example. And another view would be kind of a Lockean, contemporary Lockean, property-based view. Ryan Pevnik has developed what he calls a joint ownership theory, where citizens have labored, made contributions, developed public institutions, and so they come to have ownership rights over those institutions. And they have the right to exclude non-members from accessing the institutions and the territory. I think there are problems with all of these views, which I'd be happy to go into. But basically, I share with these views the claim that the state has a prima facie right to control immigration. But in contrast to those views, I believe the best grounds for this right is not freedom of association, not national identity, not private property rights, but the idea of collective self-determination, in which the collective is defined as a people, which I'd be happy to talk more about.
Yeah, so maybe we could dig in a little bit into the say the associational views or the Miller type views about national culture. What do you see as the problem with the view of that understands the state as is like a golf club that can restrict as it pleases? I mean, off the top of my head, it strikes me that even in the United States, there are lots of associations that that now are no longer permitted to associate with whomever they want. You know, an association can't simply restrict based on race and ethnicity. But in any case, what's the issue on your view?
Yeah, so the associational view is really the view that's been developed by Kit Wellman, and it's different from the view that David Miller has developed, and I'm happy to talk about David's view later. But so yeah, Kit has this analogy with countries are like golf clubs, and I think what he misses is what's distinctive about political community, that it's a territorial state. And so if you want to join a golf club and they don't let you, you can hopefully find another golf club or form your own. And it's possible, let's say you can also exit a golf club and the costs of exit are not so high, whereas it's really hard to exit your political community. It's not a voluntary association. Maybe that's the best way of putting it. That membership in a territorial state is not voluntary. The vast majority of us become members of a political community through the accident of birth. We haven't chosen our membership, and it's very difficult to exit. And so I think there are really important disanalogies with that. And so it doesn't get us very far in thinking about immigration, especially also given the high costs of exit and the incredible vulnerability that comes from, for example, being stateless or being expelled from your political community. I think it points to a distinctive set of obligations on the rest of us, right, who enjoy relatively privileged lives, to think about what's owed to them in a way that maybe expulsion from a golf club doesn't. I'm not saying that those expelled from a golf club aren't owed some kind of concern, but just the really important differences in those two cases.
Yeah, right. I mean, there might be a kind of ethics of golf club membership, but certainly that ethics would be different than the ethics of a political membership. I mean, I take your point. So on the Miller view, which I myself find a little bit more compelling, he and say Michael Walzer, I think, have also developed, as you point out in the book, developed a view that grounds the right to restrict immigration on the value of national culture. In order to maintain national culture, the argument goes, I suppose, the state has a right to restrict immigration in various ways. What's your view on that kind of view?
Yes, and I think that David Miller develops more fully an idea that you can find in Michael Walzer's book, Spheres of Justice, the chapter he has on membership. I think Walzer was one of the first political theorists to explicitly theorize the value of membership in a political community. I mean, he says it might perhaps be the most important good because it determines access to other fundamental goods. And the way we distribute membership is by taking people in. And he says, well, who decides how this good should be distributed? And he says, we who are already members do the choosing. And he defines the we in terms of a cultural community. He has an analogy with, you know, it's like a national family. And I think what David Miller does is present a view of political community that's really based on a shared national culture. His theory of territorial rights is connected or based on his views about nationality, that national culture plays a really important role in connecting members of a nation to the land that they live on. So as people make their lives on the land, they adapt their culture to the territory. They also transform the territory according to their cultural values. So he adopts a Lockean labor theory of value, but he adds a nationalist twist in the sense that, so by laboring on the land, members of the nation add not only economic value, but they also endow the land with cultural meaning. And he says because the value that members of the nation have added through their labor is embodied in the land, there's no way for them to retain that value without also retaining the territory itself. And so that's how he connects culture and labor to the land in his account. And he also argues for, in his most recent book on immigration, he argues for the state's right to control immigration in terms of national self-determination. He favors viewing the political community as a nation. So you ask, what's wrong with such a view? I think there are at least a couple problems, and I'll just go over them briefly and happy to talk more about it if you're interested. But first, I think by defining political community in terms of a shared national culture, the theory offers a limited framework for many multicultural and multiracial political communities. In particular, I think that such a theory, a nationalist theory, has limited resources for preventing racial and ethnic exclusions where racial and ethnic identities are regarded as central to the national culture. So I want to be clear that Miller himself explicitly says immigration need not pose problems for national cultures, provided only that immigrants come to share in the common national identity. And he explicitly rejects racial exclusions in immigration policy. But I think my point is, what if particular racial and ethnic identities are considered significant to dominant narratives of national identity? Historically, race and ethnicity have played a central role in shaping what it means to be American, what it means to be British, Australian, etc. It's interesting to note that in contrast to Miller, Walzer actually bites the bullet on the exclusionary implications of a cultural theory of immigration control. When he's talking about the white Australia policy, he notes that Australians in the early 20th century faced one of two choices with respect to non-white refugees seeking admission into the territory. So these are people who are fleeing persecution and danger and seeking admission into Australia. And Walzer says, Australians could meet the duty of mutual assistance by admitting them, thereby giving up their vision of a white Australia, or they could yield some of their land to the needy strangers so they could establish perhaps a separate community, thereby preserving a white Australia. What's interesting to note here is that Walzer takes just as seriously Australians' claims to keep Australia white as he does the duty to refugees. And Miller, you know, so that's an important contrast. I think it's not surprising that an account of territorial rights and immigration control based on the imperative of preserving a distinctive culture would include claims for prioritizing particular racial identities in light of the historical salience of race and ethnicity to shared understandings of national identity. And as your listeners surely know, you know, xenophobia, racism, they're not relics of the past. According to cross-national survey data, support for exclusionary conceptions of nationhood has been relatively stable over the last 20 years. As we've seen, they fueled the rise of far-right parties in Europe and white nationalists who helped usher Trump into the White House. So I think that this is the concern is that a culture or a national identity-based theory of immigration control is ill-equipped to limit or block racial and ethnic exclusions. And very quickly, I think a second problem with such accounts has to do with who, on Miller's account in particular, has to do with who's doing the laboring. The work is performed often by immigrants and not the nation. So more needs to be said about the relationship between the nation and the members of the nation. So if only some members of the nation have helped create national institutions, why is it only those individuals who can claim the right to exclude others from access to those institutions? And as I've already said, what if those doing the laboring are not members of the nation, but those non-citizens, migrant laborers who don't share in the national identity, who work the land and build the infrastructure? And so that kind of poses a challenge for who can claim territorial control and immigration control.
Yeah, those are all very strong arguments. I mean, this is a tricky issue, right? I mean, the idea of a national culture, what it is and who decides what any one country's national culture is not entirely clear. It strikes me that a lot of these liberal nationalists like Miller attempt to thread the needle, as it were, to, you know, make some distinction between a kind of ethnic and a civic nationalism, right? And to sort of restrict appeals to any kind of ethnicity as a basis for national belonging and an appeal to some kinds of civic principles or history. I mean, so I'm not sure if that kind of appeal, you know, how much help that kind of distinction, say, between an ethnic and a civic nationalism would help on this kind of view to help block those kinds of, you know, appeals to a sort of racial exclusion.
Yes, I, you know, there was a period as I was writing this book where I was drawn to the civic nationalist side of that distinction. And I think where I ended up was moving away from national identity, even civic national identity based accounts of territorial rights and immigration control. And you know, when we talk about the idea of peoplehood that I draw upon, some might read that as a kind of civic nationalist conception.
Right, right. That's one of the I wonder.
Yeah, maybe that's where you're going. I think, and what I want to say is, it's not in virtue, because I think even civic nationalists want to say, well, you have to share certain non-ethnic attributes. It could be language. You have to speak English. It could be certain customs, right? The question is kind of the task for the civic nationalist is to specify and flesh out what it is that everyone has to share. And I think where I want to move us to is thinking about, well, it's not so much the attributes that you share, but the fact of your participation, the fact of participating in collective life, in your local community. So it's something that you do and not some attribute that you possess or come to possess. I think it's just that distinction between civic and ethnic is slippery and blurred and hard to maintain. And so I think I wanted to kind of shift the conversation away from you must share this list of attributes to it's the fact of your participation that really kind of is the basis of your belonging or your inclusion in the political community.
That's a really helpful way of putting it. It also makes clear for me that, you know, the distinction here is also a distinction about value, that, right? I mean, for the civic nationalists, you know, the value is invested in the nation, national culture as a whole, whereas on your view, the value lies in the individual need for collective self-determination, right? That individuals have a certain desire to participate in public life, and that's the sort of basis for why it is its value. And so in a liberal setting, individual values are sort of more compelling, I think, than appealing to sort of collective community values.
That's right. I think I'm trying to bring into this conversation about the normative literature on immigration, a focus on this collective aspect to self-determination, which is tied, of course, to individual self-determination. But I believe that individual freedom depends on having some degree of control over the conditions under which we live. And I think the idea of collective self-determination captures this idea of the importance of collective control.
Yeah, so maybe you could lay out your view about collective self-determination, what it means and what its justification is. Because one of the things I'm interested in as we get through it is maybe does it slide into the civic nationalism after all? one of the things I'm wondering about is how individuals who participate in collective life, would they on this view require certain kinds of preconditions, like, say, a common language in order to participate at all, right? In other words, I wonder how much a kind of common civic nationhood might be required on view. But anyway, that's an objection to come. Maybe you could start to sort of lay out your view about collective self-determination.
Sure. And I'll start by just saying a little bit about the idea of collective self-determination. I mean, the basic idea, it's a moral claim of a group of people to rule itself. And it's recognized as a fundamental right in various UN charters and covenants. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights says all peoples have the right of self-determination. By virtue of that right, they freely determine their political status and pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. So there's an internal and an external dimension to collective self-determination that might be helpful for sort of fleshing it out. So the internal dimension is the idea of popular sovereignty, that the people are the ultimate source of political authority. And so it's the people that must authorize the binding collective decisions that the government makes in their name. The external dimension we might think of in colonial or post-colonial contexts, right? The external dimension has come to be understood as applying to all peoples who seek independent political control over their common life. So colonized peoples have appealed to the idea of collective self-determination to mobilize against colonial governments. So I think next I want to talk about who the collective is. How do we define the agent of collective self-determination? And I think here it's helpful, as you anticipating the objection that we're going to discuss that you raised, to distinguish my view from nationalists like Miller. So Miller defines the collective as a cultural group. And by contrast, I believe we should define the collective, as I've said, as a people. So what is a people and how is it different from a nation or a cultural nation? So I think the idea of peoplehood is more capacious. And as I've already said, based on participation, not possessing particular cultural markers. So to be a member of a nation, you must share the kind of whatever the key components of the national identity are. Conceptions of nationhood do have a component of willing in the sense of, I think Ernest Renan has this idea of the daily plebiscite, that you have to will your membership in the nation. But I think still for cultural nationalists, sharing the cultural attributes is central, is necessary for membership in the nation. And by contrast, what I think is essential about peoplehood is participation and efforts that aim at collective self-determination. And it's true, I think political and cultural motivations are often fused together when groups mobilize for some measure of collective autonomy. But by using or appealing to the ideal of peoplehood rather than nationhood, I want to foreground political agency over cultural identity. But you're right. I mean, the objection you raised sort of said maybe there are some what appear to be cultural attributes that need to be shared in order to get the participation off the ground, for example, sharing a language. And I think that's an important practical point. And you're right that we do need some common medium of communication, although we could also have, you know, a bilingualism and translation and in multilingual societies. But I think the important point here is that it's not possessing the ability to that speak that language that makes you a member of the people, right? But it's your kind of your participation and your intent to kind of participate in and advance the purposes of the group. So, and I should say many nations count as peoples, but I see the category peoples as broader and as including groups whose members don't necessarily share a common national identity. But you're right. I think if you stretch and dilute the notion of national identity so much, it may start to look like what I'm calling peoplehood. But again, it's a kind of a different foundation for the idea, which is agency and participation for peoplehood, as opposed to possession of cultural attributes for the nation. So, for example, Canada is a people that includes multiple nations, including Quebec, and indigenous communities and immigrants who may not necessarily possess the central markers of Canadian nationhood, according to the nationalist view. Does that help?
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, maybe to make the question more pointed, I mean the Canadian example is a good one. So, I mean, talk about sort of collective self-determination through certain institutions. And my point was about, to have participation, you need certain kinds of preconditions to have a common participation as opposed to just people talking past one another. And, you know, you may think, you know, language is one, right? But so I guess the question is, on your view, does sort of an ethic of membership point more in a assimilationist direction or a, you know, multiculturalist direction, right? Or maybe that would be sort of up to, either way would be okay based on the kind of whatever the people choose on through sort of fair procedures, or do you think sort of one direction is kind of baked in already?
Yeah, I think part of what's attractive to a kind of broader, more inclusive notion of peoplehood over cultural nationhood for me is that it can better accommodate multiculturalism and kind of the cultural diversity that already characterizes, many liberal democratic societies. Maybe I could give you a concrete example since we've been talking about language and how important is that and should that be a prerequisite to being a member of a people. So my mother, who, you know, studied and for the citizenship test in the 1980s and became a citizen, I think about 5 years after she immigrated, she has some friends who failed the citizenship test a couple of times. And it was partly because they're limited English speakers. And it was really hard for them to learn the language. And they continue to be limited English speakers. But I want to say, and so they don't quite possess if it's some threshold view, right, on some vision of cultural nationhood where you have to be able to speak it to a certain extent before we really think of you as a bona fide member. And I think on my view, I want to say they are members in virtue of living here, participating here in their local communities. And my mother's friends, they identify, right, with, and they're kind of proud to be members, they're not good English speakers. But I still want to say, right, that they're members, my conception of American peoplehood. So that's one example or one context in which maybe there's more space or greater accommodation of multiculturalism within a peoplehood view.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I think of your view in that sort of way that there's a kind of, your view has a participatory element, that they're the important feature of collective self-determination is participation in common institutions. Of course, common institutions have a history, and so they have a kind of identity in a certain way. But I take it part of your view is aspirational in the sense that the sort of slogan that you use, the open doors idea, that we aspire towards a set of institutions in which there can be maximal participation from people who come in. Right. So that we need not be tied down to the features of the way that we participated in the institutions and collectively self-determined in the past. Does that make sense? I mean, does that ring true to you? That's sort of what I was picking up in the chapter, but not sure if that's on track or not.
It is. Yeah, there is an aspirational, it's an ideal, definitely, this peoplehood. And and it's forward looking, absolutely, in the sense that their kind of participation is striving toward this shared aspiration of collective self-determination. And it's sort of intentional participation in that project that is the basis of your membership in a people. Definitely.
Yeah. So then I guess that leads to the next question, which is about, so how you get from collective self-determination to the legitimacy of state restrictions on immigration. Because I suppose if I'm an open borders person, I might read your argument and say, well, I think you can be for open borders and for collective self-determination, right? You open up those borders, and then whoever comes in can participate in this grand project of collective self-determination. So what's the justification based on collective self-determination of the restrictions on immigration?
Yes. So I think it's important. Thanks for this question. Yeah, to connect the idea of collective self-determination to territorial rights, and in particular, the right to control immigration, because your point is maybe we can unbundle this, these things. So, and I think first it's important to say that we can, so my basic claim is that to exercise self-determination on behalf of the people it represents, the state requires territorial rights, the right to make and enforce laws throughout the territory. And so we can think of territorial rights as a bundle of rights that includes the right of territorial jurisdiction, the right to control resources in the territory, and the right to control the movement of people and goods into the territory. And I think your question's really getting at, why can't we just unbundle and take out the third part? And you could still be collectively self-determining over the territory and over resources. And I think this gets at a really important conceptual point. It is possible to unbundle these different parts of territorial rights. So for example, prior to the recent European migration crisis, many European countries had agreed to follow a policy of open borders with other states who also signed on to what's called the Schengen Agreement. So they still retained control over land and resources within their own territories, but they had a policy of open borders with those other countries. So yes, here's an example where immigration control is unbundled from these other aspects of territorial rights. But I think this example does not undermine the conceptual point that immigration control is a part of the bundle of territorial rights. So what do I mean? So the fact that Germany signed the Schengen Agreement did not render Germany's right to control immigration moot. Instead, Germany exercised its right to control immigration in a way that permitted open borders within the Schengen area. So the right to control immigration continues to remain a part of the German state's bundle of territorial rights, but the way it's exercised that aspect, right, of territorial rights is to allow for open borders. So I think to put it a different way, Germany still retains the right to control immigration, but how it exercises that right might be to permit more open borders or entirely open borders with other countries with whom it has signed the agreement.
Right. And it has that right in the first place because it requires it in order to make possible collective determination.
Yes, I see territorial rights as kind of necessary for the exercise of collective self-determination. So for a group of people to be collectively self-determining, they need control over territory, control over resources in the territory, obviously through representative institutions, right? But also control over the movement of people into the territory, that I see all of those as important dimensions of territorial rights necessary for the exercise of collective self-determination.
Yeah, the next part of your book is on open borders, which is maybe it's good to turn to that because which I found great. I often teach a couple weeks on immigration in an undergraduate class, and we talk about libertarian and left-leaning open borders views, and the students, it's like a revelation. Wow. Okay. All right. So sometimes we have difficulty kind of coming up with arguments against open borders. I really appreciated this part of your book because there are some very good arguments against open borders. So maybe you can lay them out for us.
Sure. Maybe offline you could tell me more about your students' reactions.
Sure.
I'm curious. Yeah. So why not open borders? I think first it's important. I mean, in part two of the book, I really lay out what I take to be the strongest arguments for open borders. So I have a chapter on global distributive justice arguments for open borders, and then another on kind of that appeals to the value of freedom of movement itself. And just to make my task harder, maybe I could really present one argument, which is along the kind of libertarian line that also focuses on the efficiency and the massive economic growth that proponents of this view argue would come about in a world of open borders. And so the economist Michael Clemens has made this, he puts it really provocatively, and he uses the metaphor of trillion-dollar bills left on the sidewalk by having immigration restrictions. And if we would just open borders, you know, global GDP shoot up, and it would really work to the benefit of everyone. And so he uses this example of if we divide the world into two regions, rich and poor, in a world without borders, half the population of the poor region migrates to the rich region, and he calculates that there would be a $23 trillion kind of movement upward in global GDP. And the world would gain $23 trillion, 38% of global GDP. And I think the problem here is that to realize the predicted global economic gains, billions of workers would have to move. And logistically, I think just the sheer number of migrants might make it impossible to achieve the economic gains. But even if billions of workers were able to move and be integrated into the places that they move to, the gains from open borders dependent on how destination countries react to that influx of migrants. Migrants aren't only workers, they're also people with particular identities. And so Clemens acknowledges also that the large influx of low-skilled migrants would put downward pressure on the wages of low-skilled domestic workers, which raises concerns about distributive justice for fellow compatriots. So that's one of the arguments. And as I said, there's also the global distributive justice argument for open borders. And I think so I've already talked about what I think is wrong with the global efficiency argument. For the global distributive justice argument, that just begins from the powerful moral premise that all human beings are moral equals, and then goes to the conclusion, right, that so they draw from this premise of everyone being a moral equal, that everyone should have global equality of opportunity, should have access to global equality of opportunity, and to have access to economic opportunities, you need the freedom to move to where the opportunities are. So that's one important dimension to the global distributive justice argument for open borders. And what I try to do in that part of the book is to say that in a world of open borders, it's not the most disadvantaged who would benefit, that it's often those who already have resources and ingenuity who end up moving. And so if your primary goal is to assist the world's most disadvantaged, that global development aid and foreign assistance, that those are more better ways to address than to open the borders, because it's not the world's disadvantaged, the most disadvantaged that will end up moving. And if anything, it might end up, so it's hard to know, because we don't live in a world of open borders, but there's also a kind of a neoliberal scenario where if we open the borders, it's those with the resources that would be freely moving, even more than they're already able to move in a world of restricted borders, buying up the most attractive pieces of land, having second, third houses in, that far away country, that is just as likely a scenario as those most disadvantaged moving from one place to another. And so those are some of the arguments that I use to sort of to question the means, using open borders as a means to achieve the goals of global distributive justice.
Yeah, that's a great point. Libertarians, when they make this claim, often seem to want to adopt the moral high ground that this is the way to fight global poverty, is allow people to move. But of course, the poor, it's hard for the poor to move. So just simply giving them the formal right to move doesn't afford them the substantive ability to move. So it would have to be supplemented by some kind of, allowance or subsidy or some kind of foreign aid to facilitate free movement, right? But simply opening up the borders and giving the sort of formal right wouldn't do it, right?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think global egalitarians might go so far as to say, although to my knowledge, Joe Cairns doesn't make this argument, but that, yeah, maybe not only should they have the formal right to move, but they may be entitled to assistance to move, which is a more of an egalitarian argument than a libertarian one.
Assistance from potential host countries, or assistance from sort of international organizations?
I don't know. That's not my argument, so I don't know where the assistance would come from.
Well, yes, Joe. Good. Yeah. So this is great. So I have lots to tell my students now about what to think about open borders. So the rest of the book, and maybe the rest of our conversation, we can take up about the application of the theoretical principles that you develop in the first couple parts of the book to particular immigration policy. The way you go about it, it's very interesting. You sort of talk about different types of migrants and the different normative responsibility, different degrees of normative responsibility, I think, that we stand towards them. So you first talk about refugees, and I thought we could talk about refugees first, because refugees are, well, they're quite frequently in the news, both in Europe and in the United States, for sure. So refugees, and you argue that we have the strongest duty to accommodate refugees of all types of migrants. So maybe just the simple question, what is a refugee and who counts as one?
Yes. So I'll start with the law. According to the UN Refugee Convention, a refugee is defined as someone who, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, so this has been interpreted to include gender, or political opinion, is outside the country of his nationality and unable, or owing to such fear, unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country. So what, okay, that's a mouthful. What does it mean? So basically the convention definition focuses on those who are persecuted. It does not include those who are forced to migrate for other reasons, such as natural disasters or famine. It also does not include those who remain inside their country of origin. That said, the convention definition has been interpreted to include cases not only where the state is the agent of persecution, but also where the state fails to protect individuals from harm by non-state actors, such as gang violence. And so I think that in the chapter that I have on refugees, I focus on this international legal definition. Many states have signed on to this UN Refugee Convention, and so they the domestic law, for example, of the U.S. In its asylum and refugee law and in adjudicating cases, they use this definition. They've adopted it. I think in the normative literature on refugees, some have argued for a much broader definition of who counts as a refugee. Andrew Shaknoff is probably the most prominent example, and he argues that persecution, sure, that's a sufficient condition for who counts as a refugee, but he says it shouldn't be a necessary condition because there are all sorts of reasons that sever the relationship between an individual and her country of origin. And so he would include in the definition of refugee those suffering severe economic deprivation and those who have suffered natural disasters, for example. And so I agree that people forcibly displaced by natural disasters, by famine, have urgent needs that must be met. But I think I resist just broadening the definition of refugees for two reasons. First, it would include people in dire need who remain inside their countries of origin. And then the burden is on people like Shaknoff and others who favor a broader definition to develop an account of humanitarian intervention that shows when it's permissible for states to intervene in the affairs of another state to provide protection to those they want to call refugees. And this raises a whole host of challenges that he doesn't address. And I think a second problem just shows a difference of method or approach to thinking about what's owed to those who are in dire need. And so I think that principles of humanitarian assistance, principles of justice, are principles that require us to assist those who cannot meet their basic needs, but we should specify the content of our duties to different people in need in a way that's sensitive to their particular situations. So I think there's a tendency in the literature, scholarly literature on refugees, to separate the question, who's a refugee, these definitional issues, from the question, what do we owe to refugees? But I think we should pursue those two questions together in tandem to provide practical guidance. So what's my view instead? I think instead of stretching the definition of refugee to include all forcibly displaced people or all people in dire need, we should instead extend international protection to other groups of forced migrants who together with refugees constitute what I call a broader category of necessitous migrants. So I think there are reasons for focusing the refugee definition in particular on persecution. That doesn't mean that we don't owe assistance to other necessitous migrants, but again, the appropriate form of assistance will depend on the particular situation of the particular necessitous migrants. So, for example, we can see international assistance is being extended to a wider circle of people beyond those who count as a refugee. So, for example, people displaced by natural disasters, earthquakes in Haiti, floods in Pakistan, tsunamis in the Philippines and Indonesia, that they are a focus of international concern and have received large amounts of foreign assistance. But often I think, and sometimes in these cases, they can return to their countries of origin. And I think, but what's distinctive about refugees in many cases, and sometimes when conflict has subsided, those who have been recognized as refugees can return to their countries of origin. But in many cases, especially in protracted situations of war and conflict such as Syria, right, the vast majority of refugees what they need is membership in a new state. And so that gets at some of the important differences, I think, between refugees and other necessitous migrants.
Yeah, I figure sort of on the highest rung of need would be individuals who have to exit a failed state, as it were, right? I mean, so that if there's no longer a state, or if the state is riven by civil war or something, that they're unable to return to, they have the greatest claim of membership on the world community, as it were, right? And then I suppose you go down the ladder to, I mean, is that the way you think about it? I mean, this sort of the possibility of return, and how possible is it to return to the host country? That's where you would think about the degrees of responsibility.
Yes. So I maybe instead of a ladder, it's just sort of recognizing that there are going to be different durable solutions depending on the particular situation of the necessitous migrants in question. And so, right, sometimes voluntary repatriation or voluntary return is possible. In other cases, resettlement is necessary, as you suggested. And so I spend a lot of the chapter on refugees talking about how to distribute the responsibility to assist refugees, and thinking about who bears that responsibility.
Yeah, maybe here we can return to the question I asked earlier about the empirical situation of the receiving countries. So how relevant is the empirical situation of a country to how much responsibility it owes to the world's refugees?
Great. I think what I argue for is that a kind of fair distribution of responsibility sharing toward refugees should be based on the capacity of states to take in refugees. And so currently the way this responsibility is distributed falls heavily, most heavily, on developing countries. So just to fill in briefly a little bit of the empirical picture, about 86% of refugees today are hosted by developing countries. More than half of all refugees are from three countries, Syria, Afghanistan, and Somalia. And the top host countries, the countries hosting these refugees, are Turkey, Pakistan, Lebanon, Iran, Ethiopia, and Jordan. And these host states have set up refugee camps, and some have sought to restrict the mobility and work opportunities of the refugees rather than to facilitate their integration. And partly the hope is that these refugees will not permanently settle in these neighboring countries, because often, you know, where refugees are able to escape to is the countries nearby. And so I argue that wealthier countries like the U.S. should do more. And to resettle and take in refugees. But the capacity of states is relevant. And that, how do we define the capacity? So population size, population density, GDP, those are factors that would go into it. And your question gets at, should we also take into consideration how maybe it's past history of taking in refugees, or how many other migrants they've already taken in. And I think all of that should be part of the conversation in thinking about refugees and the responsibility to take in refugees. We might say Germany, having taken in over 1 million refugees coming in to Europe, we might say they probably come closest to having borne their fair share of responsibility toward refugees, and Canada is doing more than the U.S. The U.S. Under President Obama, he had agreed to take in a higher number than had been the case in the past. President Trump cut that number by half, and kind of brought a halt to the whole system through the travel bans that he signed. So does that get at the?
Yeah, it does. I mean, in the thinking about it in terms of capacity is helpful, I think, and if you think of it in economic terms, you know, we're a rich country, we should take in more, clearly. I mean, but one of the things I think, you know, I've read it's certain places, they think about, maybe you did think of it in terms of the cultural capacity of a nation to take in its share of refugees. And I guess this, again, gets back to some of the empirics that we talked about at the beginning, that does it matter, you know, if you get up to a certain percentage of foreign-born individuals in a country, and it leads to a kind of destabilizing effect that leads to a kind of rise in a far-right party I mean, that's bad for everybody, in other words, right? So is that normatively salient, or should that go into the picture, or should we say, look, we shouldn't have our normative picture be held hostage to people on the far right, right? We should persuade them or ignore them or whatever, and bear our fair share. I mean, I guess the question is, you know, how much is the backlash effect that we're seeing? Should we take that into account, you know, normatively?
I think this concern about backlash against refugees and migrants, and its fueling of nativism and xenophobia is a really serious concern. Definitely, we should not ignore this and the forces that give rise to it. And I think some might argue that such factors, and this is implicit in your question, should count. So this cultural backlash should count in determining a state's capacity to take in refugees and other migrants. And I think in my view, and I argue this in the chapter, when it comes to liberal democratic states committed to basic norms of equality, nativist attitudes are not an acceptable reason for refusing to take in refugees. Such attitudes, I think, say more about the willingness, not the capacity, of states to take in refugees. And the proper response is not to give in to nativism, but to engage in public debate and persuasion to counter nativism. And I mean, we might look to Europe, and in particular Germany and Angela Merkel and her sort of humanitarianism and her openness to taking in refugees, over a million into Germany. And we might draw a connection between her decision to permit that and the fueling of a far-right parties in Germany. And so there, you know, it's a really serious concern, but she still took in, right, the refugees. And there are many German citizens who believe that that was the right thing to do. But I think what's relevant to capacity is less the xenophobic and nativist attitudes, and more thinking about what is the capacity, especially of local communities, because that's where the real work of integrating refugees and other newcomers happens, right? What is the capacity of these localities? Do they have sufficient resources? Are they able to assist the refugees that are coming in? I think those are considerations that we need to think about in thinking about capacity and not accepting the nativist attitudes at face value.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it points to some big questions that I'm sure we don't have time here to tackle, but sort of long-term viability of liberal democratic states in the West to accommodate this project. I mean, how's Germany going to do in the long term with this? I mean, my hope is that the liberal democracy is going to be resilient enough to stand up to this sort of nativist resurgence. And I hope that you know, that will bode well to the long-term viability of the liberal democratic project. But that's the worry, I take it. Let me move on, since time is short, to another sort of application that you take. You talk about, I want to just sort of skip over just for the sake of time. You talk about the families of migrants and the claims that families of migrants take on, and discretionary migrants. I wanted to talk briefly about undocumented immigrants, which is an extremely vexed issue, to say the least, in the United States. What is, on your view, what do states owe to undocumented immigrants?
Good. I'm glad you focused on this issue, because this is a really important issue, a very live issue in the U.S. today. I think perhaps many in the U.S. think that the proper response to the situation of unauthorized migrants is to deport them. That clearly seems to be the approach of the Trump administration. So the Trump administration has done away with, under President Obama, the Obama administration had adopted a priority enforcement program where they prioritized in its immigration enforcement, as a kind of proper exercise of prosecutorial discretion, those who had committed crimes, that they would target those unauthorized migrants for removal or deportation. But under the Trump administration, everyone who's unauthorized is a target. So, but this argument that removal is the right answer, by overstaying their visas or entering without authorization, they violated the immigration laws. The main violation is presence in the territory without the consent of the political community. And the political theorist Ryan Pevnuk has made this consent argument to argue that states are justified in removing unauthorized migrants unless they can show that they qualify for asylum, or their children, who should not be held responsible for their situation. So there are a couple ways we can respond to this consent argument, which I strongly disagree with. So the first is to challenge the claim that the state has not consented to the presence of unauthorized migrants. We might say, over time, and if we look back in history, that the government, together with politically very powerful employers, have played a role in facilitating unauthorized migration to meet the labor needs, in particular, the need for low-skilled laborers, and that the government's enforcement efforts have been really inconsistent over time, suggesting a kind of ambivalence about unauthorized migration. I think this argument doesn't work so well, because it's really hard to show when, the lack of consent on the part of, but also the Trump administration is clearly not ambivalent that they have ramped up enforcement. So I think a second stronger response to the consent argument is what I call the supersession argument, that unauthorized migrants' violation of immigration law is superseded by countervailing moral considerations. And so what do I think states owe to undocumented migrants? I think that they should be, after a period of time, be permitted to remain and eventually be put on the path to citizenship for two main reasons. One has to do with social ties, that people who live and work and raise families in a particular society become socially members of that society. This is an argument also that Joe Karens has made. He puts down the number 5 years. After 5 years, then you've kind of passed the threshold and you become a social member. There's some arbitrariness in where you would draw the line, how long is long enough. But I think the important point is, what's significant about the passage of some period of time, time is a proxy for the development of social connections and social ties in the communities in which people live. And the other argument, which I think you hear in a lot in contemporary political discourse too, is the idea of fair play, that many unauthorized migrants labor in the civilian workforce. They work on industrial farms, construction jobs. They clean people's houses. They tend to people's gardens. They care for the young and the ill and the elderly. They pay taxes. They contribute to their neighborhoods. That participation in these different ways generates associative obligations among all the participants. And so to deport them after they've become kind of active participants in these schemes of cooperation is a breach of these associative obligations that we develop. Some have argued that unauthorized migrants should be asked to perform, you know, a part-time military service or some form of service in order to redeem their immigration law violation and allow them to earn their right to remain. I think that such a requirement is within the legitimate power of the state to impose. In my view, however, unauthorized migrants who've been settled for a period of time and have been contributing have already earned their right to remain in virtue, right, of all of the different activities that I laid out. So in a nutshell, I think the right to remain and a path to citizenship, not only for the dreamers who often get the most attention in the media, but also a path for other unauthorized migrants is my view.
Yeah, and a lot of the discussion, certainly in the contemporary United States, surrounds immigration enforcement. So does your view have anything to say to that? If the answer is no, that's fine. But yeah, you know, there's lots of discussions about ICE and, you know, Trump's practices of trying to discourage migration through the breaking up of families. You know, the Democrats have their own alternative views of immigration enforcement. The wall, of course. I forgot to mention the wall. I can't forget the wall. Trump's wall. As far as so the execution of these policies. Yeah. You have any? Does your view sort of speak to those issues?
Yeah, I mean, I know we only have a little bit of time left, and I could go on at length about all of those things, but I would just really quickly, I think family separation is morally abhorrent. And the kind of that keeping families together is really important for reasons I lay out in the chapter on families and family-based migration. And to use that as a deterrent strategy is really morally abhorrent. And the fact that the Trump administration is now kind of backing off of that says something.
Well, Sarah, this is very enjoyable conversation, an extremely illuminating book. So let me just say again, thank you for taking the time to talk to me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. And thanks to you for listening.